Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. As you're probably aware, we've had quite a busy time lately with the Fourth Global Conference on Buddhism having taken place last weekend, and at Dharmasara Nuns Monastery we've had visiting monastics. And tonight we're honoured to have a bhikkhuni from Vietnam who's come to spend time in Perth, Venerable Vedita Dharma. And she came to visit us at the monastery. And we had other monastics from America and Thailand, and trained in the Korean tradition, in the Theravada tradition, in the Tibetan tradition. And we also had visitors from Singapore, Malaysia, Bali, Victoria, Sydney, all over the place coming to visit the nuns' monastery. And it's interesting when people come, they're like a fresh breeze coming into the monastery, coming in and asking different kinds of questions, not having the opportunity to ask questions. Sometimes people have questions which they've been keeping for a while, and then they get the chance to ask them. So tonight I'd like to talk around a couple of the interesting questions that people asked. One of the first questions that I'd like to talk on is a question about, in an impermanent world, how can we expect to have permanent relationships? And this is a good question, but it has in it one of the things which the Buddha warned about when we are contemplating Dharma, and that is to make sure that we take it up in the right way. And the simile he gave was that if you pick up a snake by the tail, it will turn around and bite you. You've got to be careful to pick it up by the head. And this question has that sense of mixing up aspects of Dharma. When the person asked it, it was almost like wanting to have an excuse for impermanent relationships, that is, not really committing to relationships. How can you expect to really commit to anything when you know that everything's impermanent? Sort of wanting a bit of an escape hatch. And in terms of understanding the teaching and picking it up at the wrong end, this sort of question is mixing conventional reality with absolute reality. In the absolute sense, yes, everything is impermanent. But in the conventional and relative sense, things exist and are relatively permanent. We know in an absolute sense that everything that's in existence, every material form, is in the process of change from the very moment that it comes into being. The molecules, the atoms in it, are in a state of constant movement and friction, and that brings about change in the outer appearance eventually. It brings about not only change in the outer appearance, but in the function of that thing, what it can do in this body, we know that the cells in this body change completely every 7 years, and that as we get older, we look differently. And the parts that make up this body start to lose their function because they get stiffer, not so flexible. They don't have all the same chemicals working in them in the same way that they did when this body was young. But we also know that this body has a lifespan which can be one breath to over 100 years. So while it's constantly changing and while it's impermanent in the absolute sense, in the relative sense, it exists and it has permanency. It has continuity. Now, just because we know that one day we're going to die, one day this body is going to cease to function, it doesn't mean that we don't look after this body, that we don't nurture this body, that we don't feed it and protect it and do all the things necessary to keep it going, to protect it, to look after it. If we didn't look after the body because we knew that one day it was no longer going to function, people would think that we were crazy. And we also would recognize that that's not useful, because we have this body, we have this lifespan, and it makes sense to look after what we've got to the best of our ability. Even though we know that it's ultimately impermanent and it's changing all the while, it has relative permanency. And so we have to look after it, and we do look after it so that we can make the most of it while we've got it. It's the same with relationships. People that were our best friends when we were in fourth class at school. At the time we were in fourth class at school, these people were crucial to our well-being. They were the focus of our attention, the people who we shared our joys and our happiness with, shared our miseries with. And we may not even know where those people are now. We may not even remember exactly what they looked like or what their names were. Those relationships were impermanent. But at the time we were in fourth class at school, they were crucial to us. They were central to us. And we gave them everything we had while we had them. If we thought, well, in 20 years' time, I'm not even going to know where these people live. I'm not even going to care whether I see them again. That would be foolish. We'd be losing out on something that we have at that time in our life. Even though we know that these relationships are going to change, and we may have, even by the time we were in fourth class, experienced what it's like to move away, to change schools, to go to a different city, or even to have someone that we know die. But that doesn't make it sensible not to engage with the friends we've got while we've got them. Enjoy those friendships. Make the most of them while we've got them. It's the same with relationships in our family. When I look back on my family life, I think of all of the relatives, extended family, who were so important in my formative years. People I don't see now for years on end. They aren't in my life in the same way that they were in the past, but in the past they were crucial. And when we had those relationships, we gave them everything we had, knowing that as life goes on, we're going to move away from those relationships. We're going to move on. They are impermanent, but permanent at the same time. Because even when we look back with memory to those times, those experiences that we shared, they are significant in our development. They're significant in our sense of who we are. They connect us in time. They connect us to place. So, for example, the place where we were born, or the place where we grew up, where we were teenagers. Even though those things have changed, even though we've moved away from them, they are still significant in building up who we are right now. And their significance may change. They may become less important as we grow and as we form new relationships. But they've still contributed to where we are now, to who we are now. Relationships are like this throughout the course of our life. So although they are impermanent, with continuity, they're also permanent. Because they're impermanent, that is, they don't stay at the centre of our life for the whole of our life, doesn't mean that we don't give them all we've got while we're in them. So when we come to think about how is it possible to have permanent relationships in a basically impermanent world, it's important not to mix up conventional reality with absolute reality. One of the ways that we avoid doing this and avoid not fulfilling our relationships is the basis that we have in sila, in virtue. The basis of Buddhist morality is not to harm oneself and not to harm others. And when we're engaging in relationships, if we have this sense of, well, it doesn't really matter because it's only impermanent, that is not really honouring the Buddhist value of harmlessness. In the five precepts, the first precept, not to harm oneself or others, and to cultivate loving kindness and compassion so that we protect ourselves and we protect others by trying to actively develop this loving, compassionate approach to life. When we engage in relationships, even if it's only for a short while, we engage with this attitude. We engage with the understanding that just as I wish to be happy and I don't want to be hurt, so this other person wants to be happy and doesn't want to be hurt. And even if our relationship is just for this moment, how can I honour that in the way that I deal with this person? The second precept, not to take what is not given, and to develop generosity and the ability and willingness to share what we have with others. Again, when we engage in a relationship, it may only be a temporary relationship, but we see, what can I give to this person? What can I share with this person? At least let me not leave this person with less through taking what wasn't given, taking someone's trust, taking someone's confidence, taking someone's gullibility. The third precept, not to engage in sexual misconduct, and to develop reliability in our commitments and contentment with what we have. So when I engage with someone, even if it's only for a short while, even if it's only a temporary relationship, how do I engage with them so that I don't exploit them, that I don't take advantage of them, particularly in the area of sexuality? How do I engage with them in a way which is actually sharing something that's valuable rather than taking something that is only for my own, to fulfill my own desires? The fourth precept, not to engage in wrong speech, speech which is dishonest, and to try to develop speech that is not only honest but which is able to bring people together, leads to harmony. If I'm with this person for only a short while, how can I be in harmony with that person? How can I relate to them in a way that's truthful? Not only in what I say, but in how I deal with them, my intentions towards them. How can I be honest with myself about where I'm coming from, my motivation? Can I apply the litmus test of is this truthful to my own thought, speech and action? And the last precept, not to use drugs and alcohol because they lead to heedlessness, they confuse the mind, they cloud the mind, and to develop clarity of mind through meditation practice, through trying to be mindful and aware of what's going on in our own mind before we give expression to it in our speech and our actions. So when I engage with this person, do I engage with them with clarity, with clear comprehension of my motivation? Do I engage with them in a way which isn't trying to confuse or cloud the relationship? When we abide by the five precepts, then however short or long, however impermanent or permanent the relationship is, we bring all of this integrity to the relationship and we give it all we've got. And particularly if we're talking about intimate relationships between partners, we give it all we've got on the basis of integrity, on the basis of harmlessness, on the basis of recognizing my own wish to be free from suffering, my own wish to be happy and not to be hurt. That wish abides in the heart of the other as well. And then when we meet anyone in any way, in any relationship, we're always acting from that basis. So there's no escape hatch, if you like, in the Buddha's teaching. Because it's impermanent, it doesn't matter how you do it. It doesn't matter what you do. We're all relatively impermanent, but we're all relatively permanent. And each one of us knows from experience that a loving word expressed stays with us, may stay with us for years afterwards as a pleasant memory. And we also know that a hurtful word, something done in an exploitative way, can stay as a hurt in the heart for many years afterwards. So not mixing up conventional reality with ultimate reality. Yes, in an ultimate sense, everything is impermanent, but in a conventional sense, it's relatively permanent, and therefore it matters how we do things, especially in our relationships with others. So that was one of the interesting questions that was asked by one of our visitors. Another interesting question was actually connected to this whole idea of permanency and change. And that was a question from someone who is looking after their mother who has Alzheimer's disease. And for those of you who aren't quite sure what that is, that means that her mother's ability to remember the past is becoming more and more limited. Her ability to understand what is going on in the present is getting more and more limited. And the idea of the future is just falling away. Now, this is very interesting from a Buddhist perspective, this idea of the future falling away and the past being confused and the present also being confused. Because it points to one of the things which we are often encouraged to do, and that is to let go of the past, let go of the future, and be in the present moment. Now, it's interesting in the light of the question that this person asked. They asked, how can I help my mother, who has Alzheimer's disease, to die peacefully? Now, whether it's our mother or whether it's ourselves, and whether we've got Alzheimer's disease or not, we all want to know the answer to that question. How can I be sure that I'm going to die peacefully? Because not only do we want to die peacefully because that would be more pleasant, but from a Buddhist perspective, the way that we die, the last mind moment of this life, is going to condition our next life, our future. And so it's very important how we die. And this woman was asking the question, really concerned to help her mother, whom she loved, to die peacefully. Now, the clue to how to do that is in this situation. The clue is to die peacefully, one lives peacefully. And particularly if you're suffering from Alzheimer's disease and you don't have the past and you don't have the future, you only have now. And in fact, we all only have now. Without Alzheimer's disease, we can remember the past more clearly, and we can remember or plan for the future, but neither the past nor the future actually exists. We really only have this moment now. And how to live peacefully now? Well, one of the ways is to recognize that this moment, this one right now, is the most important. And particularly for the person looking after her mother with Alzheimer's disease, that's very important. This moment right now. if you want to try and help your mother to be peaceful, it has to be right now. It's no good talking about the past and trying to make her peaceful through what happened in the past. It's no good thinking, be peaceful in the future, because if you're not peaceful now, you know that the next moment is unlikely to be peaceful because it's conditioned by what's happening in the present moment. So particularly looking after someone with Alzheimer's disease, one of the consequences of that is that the person finds it very difficult to do even routine tasks because they forget where they are. They forget what they're supposed to be doing. So they might be in the middle of putting on their clothes and then they get up and start to do something else. They may engage in inappropriate behaviour because they've lost the context of what they were doing, of where they are and what's supposed to be going on. So they may come out into the middle of a group of friends that might be visiting and they might be in their nighty thinking that it's time to go to bed. Or they may wander out of the house not knowing that they're in their nighty, just unaware of time and place. And so particularly for someone looking after a person with Alzheimer's, one of the most necessary qualities is patience. Patience so that one can be in the present moment where that person is at that moment. Patience in being with that person, coming into that person's space, but also patience in trying to deal with what needs to be done at the pace that that person can work at. So one of the things that happens is, for example, if you say to someone who's got Alzheimer's disease, we're going to go out in 10 minutes from now, can you get your clothes on? 10 minutes from now doesn't mean a thing. Get your clothes on can become a very difficult task. How do you get your clothes on? What clothes? What do you put on? So if you're looking after someone in that situation, you have to learn to say to that person, right, now we are going to get dressed. Not to go out in 10 minutes' time or not to get dressed and leave the person. Step by step, you have to be with that person, helping them to put on each level of clothing. So from underwear to outer clothing to socks to shoes, step by step. You have to stay focused in the present moment with what's right in front of you. And this requires tremendous patience and wisdom, because if you try to hurry up the person, if you try to get them to do it because they used to do it, if they can't do it now, they can't. So you have to break down into small moments every task that needs to be done. Now we're going to put the socks on. Now we're going to put the shoes on. Now we're going to put the trousers on. Now we're going to put the shirt on. Now we're going to put the coat on. And now we're going out. Now you can imagine how much patience is needed to do that day after day. And how much presence of mind one needs to have to be able to focus in on what the person you're looking after needs. And how one needs to forget about the future and just stay focused in the present moment. If one understands the process and what's going on, then it makes it a lot easier. And usually we learn from experience. If we learn from experience that you can't say in 10 minutes' time or tomorrow, or do it and I'll come back and check on you in half an hour. If you know from experience you can't do that successfully, then gradually we learn to be in the present moment, to deal with what's right in front of us, to break things up into this thing right now, and after this thing, the next thing, instead of running off into the future. Now, if you remember, the original question was, how can I help my mother to die peacefully? The way to help my mother, your mother, help ourselves to die peacefully is to pay attention to the present moment. This moment right now. Can I be peaceful in this moment right now? How can I help the person that I'm with to be peaceful in this moment right now? Because for someone with Alzheimer's, the mind is slipping away. It's no good thinking about the future because the person isn't capable of thinking about the future. They can only think about now. And this is a very powerful reminder to all of us that we only have this moment right now. When someone is suffering from this kind of mental inability, it makes it obvious to us that this is the moment that matters. Can I be peaceful with my mother in this moment? And the next moment will take care of itself. And in trying to determine how to be peaceful at death, this is the only thing we can do. We can only take each moment, one moment at a time. And just like the person who's looking after their mother, we have to work out the strategies to help us to be peaceful in this moment right now. Not worry about how we're going to be peaceful next year or how we're going to be peaceful after we finish this. How can I be peaceful right now? And obviously in this situation, the person who's the carer has to start to adjust their whole routine around what is required to look after their mother. And this is, again, very powerful for us, a reminder that when we're trying to develop this ability to be in the present moment, to stay focused on what's right in front of us, we may have to adjust some of our routines. It won't happen unless we put effort in, unless we start to learn the lessons and take them into account to change our routines. If we find that we're trying to do a dozen and one things in every day and we seem to be just racing constantly from not what we're doing now but what we're going to do next, we need to take a look at that. How can I actually get the most out of each moment? Not out of each day, but each moment. Maybe I'm going to have to do less. Maybe I'm going to have to do it differently. Maybe I'm going to have to give up some things. Maybe I'm going to have to include some things that I just can't find time for now. I'll have to make adjustments. So this question and the way of dealing with it is a very good pointer to what we all need to do, because each one of us is definitely going to die one day and none of us knows when it's going to come. And although we often care about someone else and look after them and assume that they're going to die before we do, there's no guarantee. If we can make our own minds peaceful, if we can learn to be in the present moment, give our full attention to now, then whether we're caring for someone else or whether we're caring for ourselves, the result is going to be more peace in the present moment and more peace likely in the next moment, and as we build up those peaceful moments, it's more likely that we're going to be able to die peacefully. Especially when we're looking after someone who requires a lot of care and attention, we also need to recognize our limitations. And this is one of the things which I said to this daughter, with all your care and attention, it's not completely up to you whether or not your mother will die peacefully. Each one of us has our own karma, our own karmic inheritance, and we do the best we can to help the people that we are close to make their life as comfortable, as peaceful as possible, to make their death as comfortable and as peaceful as possible. But there's always going to be that aspect over which we have no control, that which belongs to that other person. And so this is, a powerful lesson. We do the best we can, but the person that we are most closely responsible for is ourselves. So even if we're looking after someone that we care about, we have to know our limitations in being able to do for them, and also know how much we can give before it starts to have a detrimental effect on our own well-being. That doesn't mean that we withdraw from that responsibility, but we need sometimes to take a break. We need to make sure we have enough time to look after our own mind and our own body so that we can come back to looking after that person and give them all we've got, the best we've got for that time. So this actually ties into the original question about permanent relationships in an impermanent world. All of our relationships are relatively impermanent, but they're relatively permanent. And so our practice, and what the Buddhist path of practice helps us to do, is to make the most of each precious moment that we have. This moment right now is precious for our own sake and also for the sake of those with whom we share our life. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of us, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Oh, Mary? Right. The question is, if one practices meditation and mindfulness, one is relatively with it, is it possible that one can be mindful even in Alzheimer's disease? I think the way to look at it that is useful is to understand that when we're talking about Alzheimer's disease, we're talking about the brain being destroyed by disease, and the mind is something more than the brain, because if that weren't the case, at death, when the brain is dead, there would be no mind which gives rise to the next mind moment in the next life. There would be nothing that continues. And so with the mind is much broader than just the brain. Now, whether someone who's cultivated mindfulness and meditation would be able to reassert the habit of that while they are suffering from Alzheimer's disease, I'm not completely sure. But I'm sure that the imprint of mindfulness and meditation practice would still be with the mind at the time of death. So what I've heard from people in anecdotal evidence of people who suffer from Alzheimer's disease is that there are very strong traits of their behaviour which have been established in their life, like habits of cordiality, being pleasant, being someone who's courteous and considerate of others, that those traits often remain even when the person's memory and connection to the people that they're being pleasant to has gone. So someone may not recognise who you are, but they're pleasant to you because that's what they've cultivated in their life, not just in a superficial way, but in a deeper way of honouring and respecting other beings. So if that can be still there, then it's likely that mindfulness and meditation will have an impact on the mind too. So the question is about meditating with your partner and whether that's beneficial or whether, and because when you are in a partnership or a significant relationship with people, you often start to have links with them, so you have a sense of what's going on for them. You may be aware of something that's happening to them even when you're not physically present with them. Is meditating together useful, or is this useful for freedom? I think always when we're talking about what's useful or not useful in doing things, we need to look at the ethical basis of it, or the morality, the virtuous base of it, especially the sense of loving kindness and whether one is acting in a way which is for the benefit of the other, not the harm. So if you're meditating with someone with the idea that you're going to take control of their mind, that you're going to influence them in a way, which people do, you know, that they're going to be able to dominate the other person, then that's not useful in a Buddhist sense. It may be useful if you want to have control over someone or influence over someone, but it's not beneficial in terms of the Buddhist approach. But if you're meditating together to develop more harmony and more openness to each other with a sense of genuine respect and love, then that's wonderful. That's a wonderful thing to be able to share with the person who's closest to you in your life. Because one of the consequences of doing that, if you're practicing in that way, is there's a sense of the peacefulness in relationship that comes when one is able to open beyond boundaries, beyond limitations. So rather than trying to control the other person, there's a sense of strengthening the relationship because you can allow the other person to be as they are, rather than as you want them to be, which is the basis of loving kindness. Yes? So that the question is Alzheimer's a manifestation of that being's desire to let go of the past and let go of the future and just be in the now? I don't know whether I certainly couldn't say yes or no. Studies again have shown that the amount of deterioration in a person's brain from Alzheimer's doesn't necessarily carry over into the disruption to their thinking processes or the way that they engage socially. So one of the most famous studies that's being carried out at the moment is on a community of Catholic nuns in America, and this study's been carried on for many years now, I think 40 years. And one of the reasons for studying this community of nuns is that the membership of the community is stable and that the people there tend to live for a very long time. The many of the nuns are in their 80s and 90s. And all of the nuns, from the time that they have ordained, part of their practice is to keep a log of their inner life. And the nuns have given permission to for that log, that diary, which they've kept for 80 years or something, to be examined after they die. Usually it's only available to their spiritual confessor. And they've also given permission that after they die, their brains can be removed and used as part of the investigation in this experiment to see the correlation between their mental skills and their social interactions and the degree of disease in their brain. And it's been found that though some of the brains exhibit very severe signs of disease, their behaviour doesn't reflect that because they've trained their mind over a long period of time to be other, to be introspective and to be respectful of others and to act in a manner of loving kindness. So to answer your question, there could be a sense in which people who have some training can decide how far they want to go in letting go of the past and letting go of the future and being in the present moment. There is some degree of control over that. But I would think that, generally speaking, people who don't control their mind, who don't cultivate their mind through their ordinary life, would not have that capacity to choose to the same extent whether or not they're going to let go of the past and let go of the future. Because if you observe how we are in as we are now, that it's very difficult to control the mind and choose to let go of the past and let go of the future, even when we want to train the mind to stay in the present moment right now, while we've got our full mental capacity. We presume anyway, we've got our full mental capacity. So for someone who is untrained, I think it would be quite difficult to choose to do that. That would be my sense. Sorry? Yes. 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 So essentially I think the Alzheimer's is dictating, unless one has already trained the mind, as these nuns obviously have. How can we know that karma, our karma or anyone else's, goes on after we die? And how do we know it's not just wishful thinking? You can't know, and I can't convince you just by hearing my words. You can know through your practice as you start to see cause and effect arising in your mind throughout the course of your day and throughout the course of your life. The more you tune into the the motivation behind what you do, the intention in what you want to accomplish, and you see the results of that playing themselves out, the more you will see the connection between what you choose to do and what you get as a result. And you can see that in this life itself. That's one way you can start to observe. The other thing is if you start to notice, if you start to practice this path and you have confidence that arises because you see that so much of what the Buddha has taught is the truth, just from trying it out for yourself. Even if you don't understand in the deepest level of your being the truth of karma, because the Buddha has talked about it, you give it the benefit of the doubt. The Buddha talked about having seen his past lives and having seen the results of how he lived in one life, giving rise to what his next life or subsequent lives were like. He talked about being able to see how beings were born again according to their karma, not just himself but other beings dying and passing away and being reborn according to their karma. He explained people's situations according to their karma, explaining what they'd done in the past to get the fruits that they were receiving now, the good fruits and the bad fruits. And so your confidence in the Buddha develops, then, and you read all of that, then you inclined more to believe that there is something in this. And then also, there are people who, through their deep practice, contemporarily now, can see past lives, their own past lives, and know the consequences of what they've done. So if you have the good fortune to, mix with those people and to hear them speaking from their personal experience or alluding to stories that they know from personal experience, then that's also another way of getting the confidence. But really, the best way is to see for yourself how what you do deliberately, how you speak and act particularly, how that has consequences, and the consequences will be in accordance with the kind of motivation and intention behind what you've done. So if you act with good intention, if you act with kindness and loving and honesty, for example, the fruits that you get will be beneficial. Okay, I think that's probably enough.